Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
Hey guys, Mark Striegel checking in with you with a little pre-show message. What you're about to hear in tonight's podcast is actually a test run that Victor and myself did on the new live stream that we have going on TalkingMetal.com. So basically, if you go to TalkingMetal.com, on the right-hand side of the screen, you will see a live 365 player that is basically spinning music all day long. Sometimes you'll hear Victor or myself or maybe even John Astronomy hop on there live and say a few words to you. There's different podcasts. Sometimes we'll pull up an old Talking Metal episode from the archives. That'll pop up on that live player. But for the most part, it's just music that you hear playing. So if you're at work and you just want to hear some great music programmed by the Talking Metal guys and the Mars Attacks guys, go to TalkingMetal.com and listen to that player, the live 365 player. It is streaming at 128, which is, I believe, a higher quality rate than in Sirius satellite radio, and it's a hell of a lot cheaper. It's free, guys. You can listen to that music for free. So having said that, we have been doing these test live shows. I think there's been three of them done so far. Victor did one on his own. I did one with Victor a couple weeks ago, and then we did one just recently. And we're still working out all the kinks and the bugs, and it's not perfect. It's far from perfect. There are quality issues that you're going to hear tonight, and again, this is because it was a live show. It was done live. The mics peaked out at certain points, and we're still learning how to do this. So what you're going to hear tonight is a test run on the new live stream, a recording of a test run. And it was actually done on Friday, that Friday of the Memorial Day weekend last week. So cool. Check it out. Enjoy it. Have a great week, and I'll check in with you very soon with another episode of Talking Metal.
You're listening to the Talking Metal Podcast with your host, Mark Striegel, and special guest co-host, Victor M. Ruiz. iTunes number one hard rock and metal podcast. I'm Bud Friendly. Now, here are your hosts, Mark and Victor.
The podcast version, and we will start right now. So, Victor, why don't you give an official hello there?
Welcome, one and all, to another edition of Talking Metal. And about 3,000 miles away, we have my good friend, Mark Striegel.
Hey, Victor, how are you? Thanks for planning this out tonight. This show is pretty much exclusively planned out by Victor from the Mars Attacks podcast. We are here on the live stream. It's a Friday night, and
right now we're calling this live stream Mark Striegel Media. That may change in the future, but you're going to hear a lot of great music programmed by Victor and myself on this stream 24/7. You're going to hear episodes of Mars Attacks, Victor's podcast. You're going to hear episodes of Talking Metal. You're going to hear selected music blocks. Do you want to talk a little bit about some of the different music blocks we have going on, Victor?
Sure, yeah. No problem. We've gone ahead and pretty much tried to put some blocks together of music that, you know, that we think that you guys will enjoy. We put together in a 70s and 80s, like classic rock, classic hard rock mix, I would say. We've also put together an 80s playlist, which is completely different, which isn't, you know, as much Aerosmith and Maiden, Aerosmith and Zeppelin and things of that nature. It's more Maiden, Priest. You do have Ozzy thrown in there, things of that nature. Thursday nights, you have a good mix of the harder stuff, more heavier, on the heavier side, not extreme metal, but stuff like Metallica, Megadeth, Anthrax, things of that nature. And as Mark mentioned, we have Talking Metal on Tuesdays. We'll have Mars Attacks on Fridays. And on Saturday nights, we'll have Spandex Saturday nights. Nothing but, you know, the good old bands that a lot of people got hooked on in the 80s, whether you love them or not. Some people have grown fond of them over the years, but, you know, we think that there are enough people out there that love a lot of these bands, so we've got
I was looking over the playlist that you had for Saturday. What is Saturday Night Spandex, right?
Yes,
that's the greatest name, guys. And Victor actually came up with that name. I'm ready to start a whole separate podcast just called Saturday Night Spandex because I love it. And The Cult was in there. Like, would you call? Would they? I mean, when I think of spandex, I don't really think of a band like The Cult.
Right.
But I guess people who maybe were wearing spandex back in the day, or who knows, currently wearing spandex, would maybe like that band.
Well, here's the thing, and it's funny that you mentioned this. There was another one of these great lists today about the greatest hair metal albums of the 80s, and The Cult was in there, Guns N' Roses was in there, and there was another band, Tesla was in there, and I forget some of the others. I think that there's such a fine line between image and music where I think you could definitely separate The Cult from, say, Poison. But at the same time, I think the same people that are checking Poison out love The Cult as well. So I think they sort of do go hand in hand. You know, I think the lines are really blurred with a lot of what came out in the 80s, and maybe you know, as the generations have grown older and whatnot, maybe some of the poser music. And at the same time, you have younger kids that are saying, oh, no, you know, I can't mix, you know, Guns N' Roses with Poison because of this or because of that. But in the end, you know, at one point or the other, you see pictures of a lot of these bands. They did have the poofed up hair. They did have spandex.
That's true. I mean, even look at how Guns N' Roses looked when they first hit the scene. You know, I mean, they were so glammed out. And I used to know somebody who lived in Seattle, and they used to go to the clubs back in the late 80s in Seattle. And they, you know, swore to me that Alice in Chains was like a glam metal band back in those days, you know?
Yeah. And if you listen to what's the name of their box set? Nothing Face, I think.
I think so.
Yeah, they have tracks on there that sound like Van Halen, you know? So they definitely were going for that type of vibe. And obviously they evolved to what all of us have become accustomed to listening from them. Interesting that you bring Alice in Chains up. There was something that I listened to you comment on in one of the last Talking Metal podcasts, the whole William Duvall sounding like Lane Stanley bit, which I'm with you. He sounds nothing like Lane Stanley. He does a great job filling in, but I think a lot of people don't realize how much Jerry Cantrell actually, you know, contributes to that Alice in Chains sound.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, those first two records, you really had Lane doing a lot of the vocals, but even on, you know, songs like Man in the Box and stuff, Jerry did a lot of the harmony vocals. But I think and Sap, of course, is in there, the great acoustic EP. And then by the time you got to Jar of Flies, you know, the kind of the second acoustic EP, I mean, Jerry was really literally doing lead on, on a lot of those songs there. And I think that's partly because Layne Staley's, health had just deteriorated so much. And, yeah, and it's like, you know, William now in the band has an incredibly strong voice. But, yeah, I really don't think he sounds that much like Layne. I think he delivers the songs great and pulls off all the songs, and they sound so great. But I think a lot of these people are like, oh, he sounds just like Layne. No, that's Jerry sounding just like Jerry.
I agree. And one of the things that the two of us talked about the first time that we hooked up doing a show was the whole branding of bands. It's sort of a shame that Jerry Cantrell put out so many strong solo albums and they went, you know, they've been completely ignored. But once you slap that name brand on there, you know, once you put Tide on there or whatever, you know, all of a sudden everyone flocks to it. Wow, did you hear, you know, the latest Alice in Chains? And it's like, what? Did you not check out Boggy Depot and everything else that came out in between that's just as good and exciting?
Yeah, and I think Jerry probably realized that more than anybody, you know. And it's like, I do think, you know, when a singer dies, the fans are a lot more forgiving than say they are when the singer quits the band.
Absolutely.
And they get somebody else, you know. And I think it's funny because we went and saw Alice in Chains live 2 weeks ago in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Mail, and it was in Pennsylvania, so, you know, and I loved it out there because it was, you know, the true-blooded kind of American rock fans. It wasn't your New York City hipsters, and a lot of times, you know, the people in New York would say to me, well, those people don't even realize that, you know, Slash isn't in Guns N' Roses, or those people out in Middle America don't even realize that, you know, Jeff Tate's not in Queensryche, or those people out there don't realize that, you know, Layne's dead and he's not touring with Alice in Chains. And I honestly, these people did. They got it. The whole place was packed. I mean, I'm guessing it was sold out because you couldn't move in the I wouldn't call it an arena in the casino, but it was like a Roseland size room. You couldn't move, and Roseland is a big theater hall in New York City, if you're wondering what Roseland is. So anyways, it's a big space, and you know, during in between some of the songs, the crowd actually started going Jerry, 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 and it made me think, you know, they get it. They get that this is, you know, for the most part, Jerry Cantrell's thing, and he, you know, wrote most of those songs, like songs like The Rooster, which is a song that Layne did sing, I think, all of, you know, that was written solely by Jerry, and Layne did have some writing credits, of course, but it was mostly Jerry. In a lot of ways, I always feel like he was kind of the Pete Townsend. He's to Alice in Chains what Pete Townsend was or is to The Who.
Yeah, I agree 100%. It's a shame. But, you know, I guess the fans that really are the diehards really do know. And it's cool that you mentioned that that people were chanting his name and do appreciate, you know, what he's doing. And it is unfortunate also what you mentioned about, you know, the handlebar wearing fellas in New York not appreciating that, you know, that that, you know, the rest of the country actually digs good music. So go ahead.
it's so true. And, you know, and it's, you know, I love New York more than any place on the planet, to be honest, but but there is something that in some time, in some ways, is almost more true when you go out to these places in the Midwest, or even, excuse me, just across the PA border from New Jersey here, and you can see, you know, that people really still love their rock music, and it's great. You know, I mean, I go back and forth, you know, is hard rock and heavy metal, is it dead, is it alive, or what the hell's going on? And it's like, you know, I go see UDO play in New York City, and they only get 350 people showing up, but yet, you know, I go see Metallica and they sell out, you know, the arena in Newark, New Jersey, two nights in a row, you know, 15,000 plus each night, and they sell it out in like 10 minutes. I mean, that might be a slight exaggeration, but not much.
Right. Yeah, they're still packing people in.
Yeah, definitely. Cool. Well, should we get into some more music?
Yeah, let's see if I can pull this off. The Alice in Chains track was actually further down the list. Let's see if I could kick this off.
I do these live shows right now. Victor has really taken the reins here and is doing a great job learning this whole Live 365 software. So bear with us. There will definitely be technical errors. If it sounds halfway decent, we may put this out in a podcast version on Talking Metal and or Mars Attacks RSS feeds. So again, thanks for bearing with us, and thanks for listening to this test live episode of Talking Metal and Mars Attacks. In what you wanna be, I don't like what I see. Like the coldest winter chill, heaven beside you. Like the coldest winter chill, heaven beside you. Like the coldest winter well, heaven beside you. And you think you have it still, heaven inside you. So there's problems in your life, that's fed up, I'm not blind, I'm just see-through.
You are listening to a podcast version of The Last Live Show, where we play abbreviated versions of the songs. To hear the songs in full, go to talkingmetal.com and use the iTunes links in today's show notes to open your iTunes. There you can purchase the music. Using the link also helps support what we do here. Thanks for your support. We'll be right back.
are back, coming out of Soldier Head there by Jason Newsted's new project, just called Newsted. Had you heard that track before, Mark?
I had not, actually. You know, I'm listening to us talk right now, Victor, over, and it still sounds just a slightly bit distorted. Let me know what you guys think. Tweet me at Talking Metal and let us know how it sounds over your speakers at home. But to answer your question, I am embarrassed to say I haven't been too up on the Newsted album that came out. And, you know, it's, I don't know. I just, there's something about it that didn't excite me. Just having not heard it, just there's something about knowing that he was putting out a record that just didn't excite me. I'm not sure why. It's a whole nother conversation because I do like the stuff he did with Metallica, you know, but I almost felt like his attitude in recent years, like in interviews and even in that stupid Some Kind of Monster movie, kind of turned me off a bit.
I think he admitted to being like drugged up when he did the Some Kind of Monster stuff, that he was, you know, bitter and in a bad place personally. And that was like a step away from him starting to abuse painkillers after the whole rock star debacle. The EP. Oh,
I totally forgot he was on that show, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, that was. I mean, I'm thankful that I never got to see that, but, you know, what a cast of characters, Jason Newsted, Gilby Clark, and, Tommy Lee. I mean, I don't know. It just seems like an odd mix, but, anyway, go ahead, Mark.
No. I was just, okay. Yeah, I guess that rock star thing that was, it was the one season where they did In Excess, right? And then there was the other season that they did, the thing you were talking about. I don't know. And I do need to check it out because what I was just hearing on the stream here sounded pretty cool. What do you think of it?
I mean, the EP sounded, you know, to me sounds pretty neat. He's not reinventing the wheel here. I mean, I know a lot of people are saying, well, you know, it doesn't sound that different from what he did in the past. Well, you know, he'd actually done a lot of different projects that sounded nothing like Metallica, and this is the first thing that he's come back to that remotely sounds stereo. The one thing that I have found pretty interesting is, you know, people sort of calling into question him covering some Metallica songs live that he didn't actually write. I don't know. He's part of Metallica's history, so, I mean, it isn't as if, you know, I don't know, he doesn't have a right to cover the songs. He's covering Whiplash, he's doing My Friend of Misery, and he's doing Creeping Death. So, you know, he's really only doing one overly popular song by the band. So, I mean, I don't know. After all the years,
I mean, let's look at this. I just thought it was weird because obviously I tuned in this week to see him get pushed off stage or whatever happened. There was that YouTube clip and they were playing Whiplash when that happened.
Right.
And I always can't, you know, help but think, you know, how many people in the audience realize that he didn't play on Whiplash, you know? And I guess I should give, like I was saying earlier, let's give the audience credit. I guess the majority of them probably realized that he didn't play on Whiplash, but yeah, I mean, why not cover something off like, you know, the 598 EP? I mean, there was great stuff on there. I mean, you know, and Justice for All. I mean, there's he. I mean, the
Did
Black
he play
album
on that?
Is one of the biggest selling albums of all time. I mean, you know, why not hit one of those songs? You know,
right? And that's surprising because on the Black album, he did write a song. You know,
yeah. Which song did he write?
Good question. It's one of the lesser.
Yeah, not to put you on the spot, but yeah,
it's. I think The God That Failed. Maybe it's one of the lesser played songs. But
now, did he do any Flotsam and Jetsam?
I don't believe so. I believe it's all original music and the three Metallica songs. But it would make sense, you know. He basically wrote everything in Flotsam when he was part of the band.
Yeah, and but it's just I don't know if anybody cares. I mean, I saw kind of to go off on a side note, I saw Flotsam and Jetsam at the Empire Rock Club in Philadelphia, but it was after Jason had left the band. And they were very good live at the time. And they always, I thought, felt like, you know, got a little boost from him joining Metallica because suddenly everybody was talking about his ex-band, you know?
Right. Yeah, and that was my impression at the time as well. All of a sudden you started seeing, you know, all the various Flotsam artwork out there and people going back to see what he had done previous. And I guess when, you know, going back to my snide remark there a moment ago, I guess people were trying to figure out once they heard Injustice for All if he actually played on anything previous.
Right. Yeah, I think it's weird that he's playing Creeping Death and Whiplash in concert. That's just my take on it. I mean, I think Bruce Kulick, hasn't he done similar things where he's played like older Kiss songs and stuff?
Yeah. But he's done Strange Ways and things of that nature. But with most of the tours he's done, especially the last few years, he's had Eric Singer playing, you know, on most of those tours. So I guess you could, you know, I don't know. I guess you could say that it's sort of more, you know, Eric doing an extension of what he does. Whiplash is I've actually spent this entire week listening back to the Metallica 30th anniversary shows, and he does sing Whiplash in concert during those dates. So
maybe he felt like, oh, okay, I did it there, you know, this gives me license to do it on my tour,
I guess. And he actually credits, you know, the fans that showed up for those dates as being the ones that actually, you know, sort of opened a door for him to get back into metal, to sort of say, okay, well, you know what? Maybe I am actually missed here.
Didn't I read something, though, that like one of the guys in Metallica actually was giving him a hard time about that, too? Like, you know, what are you doing? You need to embrace the fan base and stuff like that.
I believe I read something similar as well. You know, yeah. I don't remember who said it, but I mean, you could tell. I mean, when he came out, people went apeshit, you know, when he was out up on stage, they were chanting his name and everything else. And, you know, for better or worse, you know, regardless of what people want to say about the band's history, he was technically part of, you know, their biggest selling, you know, era. He played on the Black Album. I mean, that's the biggest selling not only metal album of all time, but the biggest selling album of the last 20 years. So, I mean, that does, in my opinion, hold a lot of weight behind it.
Yeah, I mean, totally. And that really is impressive. The biggest selling album of the past 20 years is the Black Album. And so I guess it's no wonder Metallica still tend to do really, really well when they go on tour. And they just have some really hardcore fans, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I saw them perform the Black Album in its entirety last year, and it was ridiculous because the place was packed. This was at a festival. It was at last year's Sonosphere here in Spain. And supposedly there were 60,000 people there watching Metallica play. So,
wow.
And singing along to everything. And I mean, it was really cool. It's actually next to Army barracks. So it was funny because you'd see all the soldiers were like hanging out of the actual barracks, checking the show out, along with, you know, a slew of people all along the street. So it was a pretty surreal like backdrop.
Right. Bert Gabriel, I believe, just Facebooked me saying, where are the forums, the Talking Metal forums? Those are long dead, Bert Gabriel, long dead. Those haven't been around in a while. Bert has been probably a little out of the Talking Metal loop for a while. Hope you're doing well, Bert Gabriel. If you're listening, thanks for tuning in.
We hope you're staying out of the Tijuana prisons.
Yeah, totally. All right. So what else is going on in the rock and roll world? We had Stone Temple reappear, right? Stone Temple Pilots?
Yeah, after months of hearing Scott Weiland say how they can't fire me. There's a clause, you know, there's this, there's that. All of a sudden, they appear last weekend.
That was great, that TMZ clip where he's in the airport and he's just like, oh yeah, no, the band's still together. They can't fire me. We have an agreement. There's a contract. It's just, they must have gotten a good lawyer to figure out how to work around that agreement.
Yeah. Yeah. Or, you know, he's not up to speed with what's actually going on, which in a lot of these cases, you know, when you hear about rock stars, you know, losing track of where they're with everything that he's been involved in, you know, over the years, that wouldn't surprise me.
I also wondered, you know, if he somehow violated the contract by going out and doing this solo tour that he was doing.
And he was doing a solo tour where he was playing, if I'm not mistaken, a good part of their first album.
Yeah. Yeah. So I wonder if he, like, some, maybe, who knows, in the legal world, he violated by going out and playing the songs that he did with this band, somehow violated his contract. That's just a theory. Who knows if it's even true? Don't hold any weight to that. But the choice of the singer they brought in to, I guess, replace him is interesting because they've tried this before. You know, yeah. There was what was that one band? Was it Talk Show or something? Do you remember that?
There was Talk Show, which sounded very different to STP, and they had a singer that sounded very different. And then they had Army of Anyone, which had Richard Patrick of Filter, and had Ray Luzier on drums, who's now in Korn.
And right, and they had the DeLeo brothers, right? That's their name.
Exactly. Yeah,
we actually had them on. We had. Not Rob, was it? I think we had James DeLeo on. No, what's the
Point Pleasant, New Jersey natives, actually.
No. Robert DeLeo. Robert DeLeo is the guy we had on years ago. He was the bass player of Stone Temple Pilots and also the bassist of Army of Anyone. And he that was a great band, Army of Anyone. I went and great actually album. Saw them play down at the Bowery Ballroom.
Yeah, great album. I mean, I'm a big Richard Patrick fan. And the first thing that I thought of when I heard this track was, you know, it sounded as if they got someone to emulate, to sort of be an in-between between Weiland and Richard Patrick.
Right.
The one odd thing that I did want to comment on before jumping into the track is, if I'm not mistaken, Chester Bennington is also one of the people that Velvet Revolver tried out.
Is it? Wow. This is very interesting. I mean, I'm surprised because, I mean, don't Linkin Park just, I would think they just make a ton of money and, you know, he could just stay with them and be better off. I mean, but what do I know?
He's saying that they are one of his, most influential bands, that their first few albums got him to become a singer and so on and so forth. So who knows? Maybe it's one of those deals where he says, you know what? I have all the money I need. I just want to go out and have fun with these guys and sort of live, you know, a dream. Who knows?
Right. Cool. Well, let's check this out. I actually haven't heard this song yet. So,
okay. Name of the track is Out of Time.
You are listening to a podcast version of The Last Live Show, where we play abbreviated versions of the songs. To hear the songs in full, go to talkingmetal.com and use the iTunes links in today's show notes to open your iTunes. There you can purchase the music.
Imitation there of Bud Friendly jumping back in, and I see that as we turn the mic back on, the volume jumps right back up, so it's got to be something automatic in the software.
And so what are you doing? Are you like adjusting it back down every time then?
Yeah, I just caught it that it went from 10 to a volume of 90, so I just brought it back down to 10.
Interesting. All right, guys, you are listening to a test live episode of Talking Metal and Mars Attacks. You got Mark Striegel and Victor Ruiz. And if you're listening to the podcast version of this, you're hearing us do a live show and work out some of the kinks. So if it's bothering you listening to the kinks, you can shut it off, or you can laugh at us, or you can do whatever you want. But we're having fun. We're listening to music.
Absolutely.
That track to me sounded a very Stone Temple Pilots, so
yeah.
They're definitely, you know, keeping their sound, and I think that's the important thing for a band like that, you know, stay on brand, if you will. But, you know, going back to what I said earlier, I think they're going to have the problem that so many bands have had when you try to replace a singer, in that you know, the fans, unless the guy died, a lot of times the fans aren't that accepting. I mean, there's a few exceptions, sure. I mean, Van Halen, of course, did really well after Roth left, but there was always a big portion of those David Lee Roth era Van Halen fans that never, even with Sammy's history, and it was a good, credible history, you know, of solo records and Montrose, still didn't accept him as the singer of Van Halen. But I would say they're an exception because they did really well with Hagar too. Yeah.
I think the best example though is Maiden by far, because if you look at Sabbath had issues all the time. Deep Purple even. I mean, when Ian Gillan is technically the second singer, but even, you know, when David Coverdale came in and everyone else that followed him, obviously they've had issues. But Bon Scott to Brian Johnson, there's really been no issues there. You know, it's exactly what you're saying. That's a perfect example.
Yeah, and I think with the Deep Purple, Iron Maiden examples that you give, you're exactly right. But you know, I mean, Deep Purple did have a hit in the States with Hush, I guess, before Gillan joined. But in general, they really didn't break super big in the States, at least, and I think in Europe too, for that matter. Iron Maiden, you know, although they were starting to do well, and they'd done a tour of the States with Deano and toured the world with him. It was really that Number of the Beast album that really brought them kind of more into the public eye of the metal community worldwide. And so maybe that's why. I mean, Blaze didn't fare too well in Maiden, you know, with the fan base.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we could go on and on. Ripper Owens, there's, you know, so many people that didn't fare well. And it's interesting how, you know, almost the lines are drawn between one guy and another. But, you know, in the end, I think you got to, you know, enjoy what you have to an extent. And I think with the years that Halford was away from Priest, he put out a lot of great albums. Same thing with Bruce, which we sort of touched upon last week. a shame that maybe those albums aren't known as much because they don't have the Maiden or Priest name behind them. But still, you know, I think in the end, the fans sort of won out because you were getting two great albums a year by, you know, Halford or, you know, Dickinson solo and then Maiden on their own. So,
you know, what's interesting about Maiden too, and Blaze. And I mean, I know you've interviewed Blaze on your show, right?
Yes.
But, you know, it was that greatest hits record that they put out. What was it? Probably a couple of years ago at this point, where they did a couple Blaze songs on the greatest hits record, which was what was that called? That was called From Here. I'm looking compilations records. I'm online. From Fear to Eternity, the best of the 90s. Now I know on that record they did at least one or two Blaze era songs, and instead of putting the Blaze, the original recording studio versions of those, they put, you know, newer live versions with Dickinson singing songs, which I really felt was kind of a slap in the face to Blaze. Did you ask him about that when you interviewed him?
That's actually one of my strangest interviews ever. So I sort of didn't know where to go with him, because right off the bat, I usually ask people if they don't want to, you know, talk about certain things. You have someone that's had history in other bands, and maybe they just want to focus on, you know, what they're releasing or a set of shows that they're doing, and they don't want to talk about Maiden, or they don't want to talk about, you know, who they were with in the past. So I ask him, and, you know, is there anything, you know, you don't want me to bring up? And he says to me, you know, nonchalantly, motorcycles. I'm like, what? Motorcycles? Why the fuck am I going to ask you about a motorcycle, you know? And then later on I read that it was one of the rumors about him being tossed from Maiden was because he had gotten into a motorcycle accident. And then there was some tie-in with his wife that had passed away, you know, shortly before I interviewed him as well. So, you know, it sort of made sense after, but it threw me for a loop, you know. Initially, I did ask him, you know, what it was like when he was out of the band, whether, you know, the band asked him to leave and under what circumstances, or did he see the writing on the wall and he just left? And he pretty much said that, you know, he knew the band wanted Bruce back to go, and that he still loved what he had done with the band, and that, you know, he understood that that sort of propelled him to being a worldwide name. So he was grateful, and at the same time was, I think, realistic with, you know, his assessment of the whole situation.
You know, I saw them in concert with Blaze once, and found that he was definitely having some trouble with his voice. And I always kind of thought, well, maybe it was just an off night for him when I saw him. But in the book, the Iron Maiden book, the autobiography, Run to the Hills, they actually mentioned that he was having a hard time live, just keeping it up night after night. So, too bad. And in some ways, I mean, I'm not an expert on the music he's put out post Maiden, but that some of that stuff is pretty decent, right?
Yeah, I've lost track the last few years, but some of the first few albums did have some quality material on it. After that, I sort of lost track because he'd started, you know, recycling members, and the quality, in my opinion, started coming down with the material. But I would say the first three or four albums he put out post Maiden were fairly strong.
Cool. Yeah. Somebody just, friend John, just not John Astronomy, different John, just texted me saying that, you know, Mark taking over for Udo in Accept, that he's been quite successful, which I think in some ways he has been, at least with the critics. You know, Blood of Nations, a very successful record as far as reviews go. What's your thought on Mark taking over for Udo Dirkschneider?
His last name in Spanish actually means screw, as in a screw, as in a nail in a screw, not as actually screwing someone. But anyway, I think that Blood of Nations album is great. You know, it's got a lot of strong material on it. But I also have to agree with Udo's assessment during the interview that you did with him.
Right.
I really was looking forward to Stalingrad. I'd read some reviews, and some people had said it was stronger than Blood of Nations. And it's a good album, but I don't think it's as strong as Blood of Nations. I think what he mentions might be spot on. You know, the album, as you said, was successful with the critics. A lot of people, you know, went out to see them play. And, you know, a lot of times when bands are remotely successful, they need to, you know, strike again while the iron's hot. And I think that may have been the case with Accept. I don't think it's a bad album, you know, but I don't think it's up to the standards of Blood of Nations.
Totally. And what about, of course, I think, you know, we got to get to some music here, but what about Queensryche?
I haven't listened to the entire Tate album, and it isn't because I didn't like it. I just haven't had the time to listen to it. But the one single, Cold, everyone is all up in arms over the sound of the distortion and this and that. And I don't know. Being a fan of industrial music, that's a type of distortion that I've been used to listening to for about 20 years. So, I mean, that's not a big deal. As we had discussed in the past, the song that Queensryche has put out is tuned as if we're getting, you know, Queen of the Reich Part 2. There may be, or at least from the single Redemption, it seems like they're going to be, you know, a lot truer to what the band was originally known for, up to maybe the Mindcrime album. But it still doesn't mean that they're not going to tweak things to modernize it and to try to get, you know, other fans to listen to it.
Totally. And yeah, so we got listeners because people are texting me. People are on Facebook. People are tweeting. David Isaac was the one who suggested us talking about Queensryche there. Arun just texted me saying Chester Pendleton rules. Who the hell is Chester Pendleton?
I guess he means Bennington.
Bennington? Oh, I don't know.
From Linkin Park, I guess. I mean, I don't
know. Oh, okay. I don't know. Pendleton. What's it? Oh, see, I don't even know. Is that the guy's
Bennington,
name?
Chester, yeah, Pendleton? Chester Bennington.
Oh, Bennington. Okay. So, well, I don't know who Chester Pendleton is, but
whoever he is, we wish him lots of luck.
Yeah. And here's Bert Gabriel checking in. Wow. So cool. Glad we got some listeners out there. Let's get into a little more music. What do we got on deck here now? A little David Bowie, maybe?
Yes, we do. And we sort of wanted to bring up real quickly the death of a very important bass player that maybe doesn't get the recognition of a lot of, you know, like Steve Harris's or Chris Squires or people of that nature. But I can bet that, you know, Trevor Boulder has influenced Steve Harris and a lot of other bass players that have come out in the late 70s, early 80s, especially due to his work with David Bowie and the Spiders from Mars. And later on with his work in Uriah Heep, a perennial front runner in, you know, progressive hard rock.
Yeah, and I actually think you could argue that he had an influence just with his look that he had in 1971 and you know, with David Bowie, really like kind of, you know, laying the groundwork for the look that the New York Dolls would have and then later would be taken up by, you know, a lot of the L.A. glam metal, hard rockers, even, you know, Nikki Sixx for that matter, that hairstyle. I always thought that he had this kind of cool rocker look and that his look was ahead of its time. And let's face it, you know, Ziggy Stardust, that he played on numerous Bowie records as well as numerous Uriah Heep records. But let's face it, Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, a very influential record on all styles of music, including hard rock and heavy metal, bands like Racer X covering Moon Age Daydream off that record. And in 1971, guys, this was a hard rock record. Yep. I mean, it even said right in the back, you know, this record is meant to be played at maximum volume or something to that matter. And one of my favorite records of all time, period.
Okay, cool. So let's check out a song that I'm sure a lot of you are very well versed in. This is Suffragette City, and our thoughts and prayers go out to the family of... We're trying this test run of the live stream, and the mic jumps back up to enormous proportions.
Yeah. Huh. Is there any way you can adjust that before we go on air, I wonder?
The thing is, once I hit the mic button, like once I turn the mic off, it automatically goes down to zero. Once I turn it back on, it automatically jumps back up to 90. So I guess we're going to have to... somehow get used to, you know, turning it down real quick.
Yeah. All right, guys, you're listening to our test run of the Talking Metal live show, the Mars Attacks live show. And there's a good chance we will put this up as a podcast. So if you're listening to the podcast version, you are hearing all the little clunks and kinks be worked out in a live broadcast on May, what is today, 24th? May 24th, Friday night?
Yes.
It's already May 25th over there in Spain, where
yes,
Victor is.
Yeah.
Up in the middle of the night. So David Bowie, of course, a rocker who did some acting on the screen in numerous different movies. What was that, like Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence or something?
Yeah.
What the fuck was it?
Yeah, there was that. There was Labyrinth. He was actually in a movie, which is when he disappeared. He played Nikola Tesla, and that was the last we saw from him for so many years up until this year or late last year, was it?
Yeah, I love that movie, guys. If you did The Prestige, by the way, it's Christopher Nolan, right, who did the three Batman movies. He did, I think, in between the first and second movie, a movie called The Prestige, which is about these two magicians. Great stuff if you haven't seen it. And definitely Christian Bale is in it, as well as
Hugh Jackman,
Michael Caine, and from the Batman movies, Michael Caine. Yep. That's his name, right? Michael Caine, yeah. And Hugh Jackman, and who's the Scarlett Johansson.
Piper
and,
Perabo as well. She plays the Hugh Jackman's wife that drowns in the beginning of the movie.
Right. Spoiler alert.
Excuse me, sorry.
Yeah, that's right. So anyways, thanks for joining us on Talking Metal Live. And we are talking about a rocker who appeared in movies. And now I want to segue into a rocker who released, remember? I mean, back in the day, he was like going to do a movie for Crazy from the Heat was going to be a movie. And
Dave TV,
yeah, and it never happened. There was a screenplay. I know he talks about it, I believe, in his book. Yeah, he never really successfully made the jump to the big screen. But just this week, he released some bizarre little, 4-minute video, and I want to get your take on the video. I watched it today. When I turned on it at work, I was like, oh no, I can't bear to watch this for 20 minutes. I'm going to, my attention is going to be lost. I got work to do. And I was excited when I clicked on the clip and saw it was only four minutes, thinking that it would keep my attention. But I got to tell you, by 90 seconds, I was already spaced out and having trouble paying attention to it. Strange. And I guess the question is why?
It's interesting. It follows the pattern of people that go to Japan to do commercials, to do all types of publicity things. Dave goes over there to do a short film, which he writes and produces, and feels the need to, I don't know, show his the Tarantino he has in him. I don't know.
Yeah, it's very Kill Bill feel. It has subtitles and just the look of it. And the thing about it is, again, I after 90 seconds, I was having trouble focusing on the storyline. But basically, Dave walks into some sort of weird place. Like at first, I thought it was a horror house, but it was like a gambling house or something.
Yeah, like some back alley gambling.
Yeah, and there's these guys gambling, and they're basically talking in Japanese, saying a bunch of stuff like "you stupid American," and they, making fun of, fried chicken and stuff. And I guess they believe that he doesn't understand them, right?
Right.
And then it turns out that, hey, he speaks Japanese and he understands all this bad stuff they're saying about him. And I guess he then, spoiler alert, I hate that word, that term, by the way, but I'll say it. He goes on to kill them. Now, the thing that is crazy about this is 3 weeks ago on HBO's Game of Thrones, the Targaryen chick, the Khaleesi, whatever the fuck her name is, it's the same freaking story. She is, goes to buy these slaves, mm-hmm. and this guy doesn't think she understands the language he's speaking, and he's calling her a slut and a whore and a fucking idiot and all this stuff. And then in the end, they turn it around and suddenly she freaking kills the dude and
unleashes the dragons.
Yeah. You watch Game of Thrones?
Yep.
So is it possible that 3 weeks ago Dave saw that? I mean, I know Game of Thrones is a book and he could have read it years ago, but
sure.
It saw that and was like, hey fellas, let's put together a video where I go in and I mean, it's so close in storyline to that story thread of Game of Thrones that in that one episode 3 weeks ago, that it just it made me wonder, could he have thrown that little thing together in 3 weeks? And maybe he could have. Being a video producer guy, I think shooting and editing, it's probably highly unlikely. And it's probably just a coincidence that the storyline is similar, but maybe not. Because, you know, it is possible he could have.
Knowing Dave's past with little people, I'm sure that he's a big fan of the show to begin with. Now I don't remember the character's name, but another New Jersey native.
Peter Dinklage.
Peter Dinklage, there you go. Great, great actor who's done millions of roles and been funny and great at all of them.
And I have a metal-related Peter Dinklage story, by the way.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, one of the first Talking Metal interviews we did, and he plays Tyron Lannister.
Lannister,
right?
Yeah.
Anyways, one of the first Talking Metal interviews I did, because I think John did the first couple bunch of interviews. He's a striper. But I interviewed Fireball Ministry down at the Knitting Factory in Lower Manhattan there. And there was like 30 people in the room when they played, maybe 50. Let's say 40. But anyways, Elijah Wood was there, who, of course, played a little person in Lord of the Rings. Right. And an actual little person, Peter Dinklage, was there rocking out to Fireball Ministry.
Interesting.
Both drinking heavily. Elijah Wood actually making out with a chick through most of the set. So I know there's been rumors about his sexuality, but I can tell you he was definitely making out passionately with a chick through most of Fireball Ministries set, and Peter Dinklage way pre Game of Thrones hanging out there. I don't know what he was in at that time, if it was Nip and Tuck or something.
Yeah, it's funny because it seems as if he's been around forever. You know, I've been seeing him in roles for such a long time, and due to Game of Thrones, you know, I looked up on IMDb to see, you know, what other stuff he had been in and how many other movies I'd seen or shows with him in it. And he's not that old. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, he's in his 40s. So, I mean, it was sort of odd that it just seemed like, you know, he was like Christopher Lee, that you'd been seeing him, you know, for eons, and he's actually not that old.
Yeah. Well, thank you for saying he's not that old, because he's the same exact age as me.
Okay.
And I feel fucking old, man. I mean, you know, that's a whole nother conversation. I mean, I remember when I was in seventh grade and Mick Jagger turned 40, I was like, that fucking guy's fucking old, man. And not like he was old. He was fucking old. Yeah. I mean, I remember George Lynch was like 32. And, you know, most of the metal dudes at that time, George Lynch was definitely a few years older than everybody, you know. And I remember thinking, man, George Lynch, he's fucking old. He's 32, 33 years old, you know. And it's crazy how you judge old. But there's a lot of people who think Peter Dinklage is old. Speaking of David Lee Roth, though, there's no arguing that David Lee Roth is old. He looks good, man. When he takes off his shirt, he's still in shape, you know, and in that film. That's the one thing I'll say, that, you know, he's for a guy who's got to be 60, right? Or pushing 60.
He's got to be up around there, yeah.
Definitely looks good. And I mean, when I saw them play live a couple years back, well, more than that, four or five years back at this point, he sounded great.
Yeah, I mean, for all the knocks on, you know, on the latest album and, you know, his lyrics and this and that, you know, all the clips that I saw, I mean, I thought he looked real good in concert. The whole band looked good in concert, and I thought the album was phenomenal. So
yeah, great record, and 57 years old, David Lee.
He's almost at 60.
Guys, thanks for listening tonight. We're going to play a little Van Halen right now, and then we will come back and kind of, I guess, wrap things up. Right, Victor?
Yeah, we'll do that. Let's get into speaking of a different kind of truth, and this is actually about a part of New York where David Lee Roth supposedly has a house or lives or is an EMT or something or other. So here we go. Chinatown by Van Halen.
You are listening to a podcast version of The Last Live Show.
We are back. That was a little VH with Chinatown. And one of the things that I wanted to discuss, something that I think is near and dear to a lot of us, is the whole alcoholic beverage side of music and how a lot of bands are now jumping on the bandwagon of getting wine and beer out there. The latest being Maiden, there are all these, you know, press releases with Bruce and the Trooper beer with the taps and everything else that they're putting in the pubs in England. And what are your thoughts on bands using this route to sort of market themselves?
Well, you know, I think Maiden for a beer. I mean, it seems like they're taking it kind of seriously, and aren't they using like a microbrewery or something to? So there's the brewery that's behind the Maiden beer seems to have some cred, and my dog is freaking molesting me right now. Ozzy, go away! Come on. Anyways, yeah, and they seem to be taking it seriously. And I would think a band like Maiden, a band that's been known to hang out at the pub, that if they're going to put, you know, the effort and the name on into, you know, researching the beer that they're going to put their name on, I trust them. That's what I'm trying to say. I trust Maiden's beer because this is a pub band. They are always talking about how they go hang out at the pub before, after. Sometimes they blow off rehearsal to go do it. I mean, even Bruce said when, you know, they got back together, they were supposed to go practice and they didn't even do it. They just went down to the pub and drank. And yeah, Maiden, I'm going to trust their beer. Kiss, with Paul Stanley and Gene Simmons, a claim they don't even drink. You know, now I know Paul has been drunk on wine and stuff, and but, you know, they've always spoken down towards alcohol. I even saw Gene rip a guy a new asshole in person for being drunk. And now, you know, drunks and enjoying alcohol, maybe that's two different subjects. But I just feel like Kiss has always been so anti-alcohol that they have no business releasing Kiss wine. And what are they doing now? Do they have like a beer house or something?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to bring up. They've come out like with their own Hard Rock Cafe, and it's clean. If I'm not mistaken, there's an alcoholic connotation to the actual name of the place.
Yeah, they need to get Ace back in the band before I'll visit that place. But no, I'm just kidding. I love Kiss, of course. And it is interesting that in that Family Jewels episode, Gene actually gets drunk in at least one of the episodes. So maybe he's turned over a new leaf.
Could be. Hey, he, after all these years, decided to get married. So who knows? You know, I guess in the end, whatever sells makes them money, you know?
Yeah. And then you have, of course, Maynard from Tool,
yeah,
with his wine. And he seems to be quite serious about it from what I've read. And I saw a clip of him talking about it. So I'm not a big wine guy, but I would check his wine out, and I would believe that maybe there could be some quality there.
Right, and he's actually got a documentary regarding his vineyard and how it all came about. So it does seem like he's really involved in it, and like you're saying, it seems like there's some validity to it. And over the last few years, though, you have, you know, members of Warrant, members of Rat, Motorhead's put out a bunch of different wines and beers. AC/DC's done the same thing. So, I mean, I could see what you're saying.
I don't know. AC/DC, I don't know. They seem like they're just into licensing the name. I mean, I do feel like Maiden has at least made the effort to act like they're not just licensing the name,
right,
you know, for their beer. AC/DC, honestly, one of my favorite bands of all time. I love both eras. You know, everybody's always like, this era, Bon Scott is so much better. And okay, maybe, but there's some Brian Johnson stuff that kicks ass too. I love AC/DC. And sometimes I feel like they are money grabbers. You know, they're just, you know, if you pay enough to license the track for your movie, you get it. If you pay enough to, they want money for everything. That's the vibe I get from AC/DC. And I could see them simply just licensing their name out to a beer or wine company. Motorhead, I don't know. I kind of feel maybe the same about them. This is all just speculation and guessing on my part. What are your thoughts?
I mean, Kiss, I think, obviously is them licensing the name, but I think that the majority of them is the same deal. Maiden has been the first one where you see, you know, Bruce out there, you see him with the not the kegs, but the faucets or whatever you call it. I don't even know what they're called. Where he's actually in a pub there and he's serving the beer and whatnot.
Right, yeah.
So it seems like he's gone. Yeah, there you go. Where he's gone the extra effort to actually do the marketing side of things. Whereas the other bands, it just appears on, you know.
It, besides the alcohol is the hot sauce. I mean, everybody's got their freaking hot sauce now, you know, and it's like even our friend, I say friend, although I haven't spoken with him in probably a year and a half, Bumblefoot,
yeah,
has Bumblefoot hot sauce out. And, you know, I actually would like to interview Bumblefoot, get him back on Talking Metal to talk about these, because, I mean, did he create the hot sauce?
Yes.
Or is there just some website you can go to and you send them some, you know, labels and they slap it on the hot sauce? You know, that's. And if that's the case, stay tuned for Talking Metal Hot Sauce.
I actually...
We'll sell about three of those.
I actually, when I interviewed Bumblefoot, one of the things that we talked about was hot sauce. And at the time, he actually mentions how he had gone to all these restaurants while he was on tour with Guns N' Roses, checking out all of the quote-unquote hottest sauces in the world. And there was one place in New York that he mentions. I forget the name of the place. But he said that he had been there and he was like, oh, you know, this is nothing. I already have ingredients for my own sauce and it'll be out shortly. And it took him a few years. I think it took him like 2 years maybe between the time that I interviewed him for the hot sauce to come out. But it was funny because the timing was odd because Michael Anthony has his hot sauce. Joe Perry has hot sauce, you know.
Totally, yeah.
So...
There's others too. I can't think of them off the top of my head, but there's definitely others out there with hot sauce, you know.
Now, would you think there would be a John Astronomy hot sauce and then a Mark Striegel hot sauce? Or would they just...
Yeah, mine would be hotter. No, I don't think... listen, we haven't even sold all 50 t-shirts that we had made, so we'll probably...
can bundle them, hot sauce and a t-shirt.
Yeah, hot sauce and t-shirt, right, there you go. So, by the way, you can buy a Talking Metal t-shirt in the store section. And, guys, thanks so much for listening to this episode. Support us by going to Mark Striegel Media, by going to... MarkStriegelMedia.com, that is, to TalkingMetal.com, to visit Victor on MarsAttacksPodcast.com, right?
MarsAttacksRadio.com.
MarsAttacksRadio.com. Damn, I should know that. and you got like a Facebook page that people can like, Victor?
Yes, it is Facebook/MarsAttacksRadio. And the Twitter's the only one that's sort of odd, which is... Mars Aries 2005. I couldn't get them to switch it to Mars Attacks Radio, but it is what it is. If you go to the homepage of MarsAttacksRadio.com, you've got links to all that good stuff. So just check that out.
Cool. Yeah, somebody just threw up a on Facebook, just threw up a private label food branded sauces. I'm wondering if this is a link you can go to. Yeah. Expand your brand. Yeah. This Michael actually just threw this up on Facebook in the comment section that you can actually, I guess, Michael, what you're telling us is you can just go, yeah, here, step one, choose your product. Step two, choose your label. Step three, order your sauce. Cool. There you go. Talking Metal hot sauce on the way. Thanks for the link, Michael.
Excellent.
That is at brandedsauces.com.
There you go. John Astronomy sweet and sour sauce. I can't wait to see it in the stores.
Trooper to take us out.
There we go. Yeah, let's wrap things up with the Trooper. Thanks once again to everyone that checked in, listened, sent feedback to Mark, especially with the links on how to make our own sauces. News on that in the future. And that's it. Thanks for checking out this test run, and you may be hearing this in podcast format shortly.
Take care, guys.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.